Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort. This week we are featuring five country music hitmakers in honor of the 51st annual CMA Awards. Hope you had a chance to see Brad Paisley and Carrie Underwood host the 51st annual CMA Awards this week on ABC with collaborations by Kelsey Ballerini and Reba McEntire, Brad Paisley and Kane Brown, Maren Morris and Niall Horan, and Pink doing Barbies. It was country's night to shine with unforgettable performances and the best of the best honored in several categories. You can check out the winners and highlights at cmaawards.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's guest is our final guest of CMA Week. We really appreciate all of you guys for listening. This one is Zach Crowell, a Nashville native who listens to all kinds of music. I mean, that's why you get artists like Sam Hunt. He has worked with Sam since the very beginning, and they have managed to break down all kinds of barriers for country music. Zach is a friend of mine, and he was super hospitable from the very beginning, and this trip to Nashville was made partly because he hit me up and said, hey, why don't you do a trip to Nashville? So I'm excited to have Zach on. He signed a yesterday's guest, Ashley Gorley, so it's all in the family here at And the Writer Is. This one is featuring Zach Crowell. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. This week's writer has written and produced a slew of number one country records, but not your typical ones. He has written the kind that sit in the top 10 on overall iTunes chart for like 4 months. In a genre that rarely sits amongst the Justin Biebers of the pop world, this writer bends the rules of what's country and what's pop. From Nashville, Tennessee, this gentleman has worked his way up from day jobs to Grammys. And the writer is the humblest of masterminds, Zach Crowell. Welcome.
Wow. It's funny, I was listening to that going, I did all that? That's crazy.
But it is pretty crazy when you think about the, you know, when we're all in this together, we're all writing songs in different cities and all that stuff. And it's nice in an era where there aren't aisles in stores that you can look in the top 10 of iTunes and you can see Sam Hunt along with, you know, yep, DJ Khaled. And
one of my favorite things is when I see people comment somewhere or something on the internet and say, I never listened to country music until I heard Sam Hunt. I love that.
Yeah.
Like, it's all the hate that he gets. It's nice to kind of have the other side of people who are being exposed to a whole new...
Well, even your first cut's a Grammy-winning song,
yeah, that was
right?
That was a weird...
And it's R&B.
Yeah, that was a
and
weird
it's
backwards
It's not country.
No.
So your background isn't really country anyway.
Absolutely. It would be country because I'm born and raised in Nashville and I've been around country music my whole life, but I never thought, it sounds so dumb to say, I never thought to pursue country music in any sort of way. I'm a 90s kid. I grew up on 90s hip hop and R&B. And being in the South, it was all Cash Money and No Limit and Suave House and all the anything Manny Fresh ever did. My goal is still to meet Manny Fresh. And but it's funny because I spent 15 years pursuing urban pop music. And
when you say you're pursuing it, that means that you're sitting in your house.
Just making beats and writing songs and writing hooks. And, you know, I mean, it starts off from day one, buying a MPC and wanting to be Manny Fresh or Dr. Dre or Pharrell or whoever was doing it. And
did you think about moving to Atlanta, Miami, I never did.
And I've realized God's master plan. Like, it made sense that Nashville, you can do it all from Nashville. You just can't fully commit to it, but like, you can officially do it. You know, there's a hip hop scene and there was a underground, you know, rap scene that you know, was bubbling and still is. And so I was just kind of in that scene for the longest time and learning how to produce and play and write and interact. And so, you know, the quick story is I did all that for 15 years.
But let's start from the beginning, so it's not such a quick story. You're born in Nashville, and your parents are musicians. Are they not? Are they
My dad is a musician. He's in still a band to this day that he's been in since high school.
No way. Yeah. What's it called?
The Exotics. They still like play gigs in town and like sell out things. And
do you go to them?
Yeah. I mean, they play once every month or two or so, and but they, you know, sell out stuff.
Is
but they
it covers play or is
covers
it all?
And stuff. I think they did original stuff way back in the day. But now they just, you know, they play, you know, retirement things and high school things. And
did you grow up going to these gigs?
Yeah, not like every day, but two or three times a year. My dad was always. But there were always instruments. Here's the funny thing: there were always instruments around my house, guitars and bass stuff. And my dad sings, but I never played them. I never thought to play them. I was always playing sports. I never thought to pick up a guitar when I'm 12, just sitting around the house. There was always one, but I never did. And
did you know how to play it and you just weren't into it?
No, I never had an interest, but I was a music kid and I was a music nut. And I was the kid in his group of friends in high school who was the music. I was the DJ of the friends, you know, like I made mixtapes for my friends and I was the guy at the party who was at the stereo, just, you know.
And
I was
at
that
this
guy.
Point you're playing, this is, no, there's no, there's no, I mean, not playing, but I mean, at this point you're, the music you're into, none of it's country. Or it's mixed in there.
It's
with
mixed, but it's rooted in hip hop though. Uh-huh. It was, you know.
Who introduced you to hip hop?
I was always attracted to that kind of music. I have a memory of whenever Will Smith's Summertime came out. I have a memory of laying on my living room floor, writing it out on my Christmas list that I want the single for Summertime, which is still a smash hit song to this day. It's better than all this. But so, I mean, I would have probably been like 10 or something. And then
Your parents get it? When you were like, oh, I like hip hop. And they like,
they didn't. I really don't think they knew much about it. Like they, I don't know. I don't know. They never gave me a hard time about it. I specifically remember, like, this was, I feel, a pivotal point in my life. I remember in sixth grade, like the audio tech class, it was GM Tech. I remember dubbing The Chronic from Nick Doral. They let me dub The Chronic, and I remember going home and listening to The Chronic on my couch, and I heard my dad coming down the hall, and I'm like taking my headphones off and putting my tape player under the cassette. That was a pretty raw album, you know, and but that record killed me. I mean, I feel it probably affected every single one of us, you know. And
I've recorded in that room this week. Which room that they did? Well, actually, I was recording with Mike Elizondo, and it was crazy. The original like Death Row room. So shout out to Mike. But
yeah,
it's crazy to be in that room and be like, oh man, the energy of
like that's one I wouldn't like. Still to this day, when I go to LA and I drive and I see names of streets or you drive past something and you see Compton or you see whatever, I get excited. Like, these are, I'm sure, like hoods and like awful places that crazy things go down but I like smile as if it's like a museum or like a historic place. But yeah, man, so I, you know, it was
when hip-hop. When did you go from dubbing records to trying to make your own?
I graduated high school and I want to say I made my first beat in high school, my senior year at a friend's dad's house. I still have it.
Is it good?
No, it's hysterically bad. Like but it has like all the from the keyboard, it has like the applause sound and like ocean sounds and those sounds that come on those little things. And
But did you name the beat?
No.
Yeah. Did you ever show anybody?
No, I would show it right now. It's hysterical. Maybe I could send it to you if you want to, whatever.
No, you definitely should send it to us.
But it's, you hear it, you go, it's a kid who has no clue about music trying to make music.
In retrospect, do you look at it and think that maybe you knew more than you thought?
Probably. There's, like, I've realized now as an adult, and I'm not the singer, I'm not the player, I'm not the musical genius in the room. I've realized I'm the guy who is looking for candy, who's always looking for catchy things. And I've realized that's my best role in the room. So it's not to be the poet in the room. It's not to be the vocalist. It's the guy who's just waiting, who's just constantly listening for catchy things. Because if I boil all the music I've ever listened to down, it's rooted in catchy. The catchy parts are the parts that I like.
Right.
And I've, you know, now over the past few years just learned to embrace that. I'm like, there are plenty of good musicians who can play better than me. I'll hire them to do it. And there's plenty of good singers and there's plenty of whatever. But I've realized everything back to Will Smith's Summertime, like there's little, the part where he says 2 miles an hour so everybody sees you. That's a catchy little hook and how he did it. And it's those little catchy moments. Because it's not about the lyric, it's about the, I don't know, but
it's like the feeling and the vibe.
The feeling and the vibe, and it's like,
it's
so that's
real talent, because there's, it's more, people in Nashville co-write naturally, I feel like.
Yes.
People don't look down on co-writing, and somehow in the pop world, people tend to look at it as like, oh, well, they didn't write all their own music, and which is very strange, because that's not really how it's ever worked.
Yeah.
But in the co-writing community, everyone really has something of a defined role. Even if everyone can do everything, it's still being honest with themselves enough to say, all right, well, I'm probably the melody guy in this room. There are some rooms where I don't tend to write a lot of the lyrics, and there are some rooms where I write all the lyrics, and there are some times where I do both.
Like, you know? To me, it makes perfect sense. On a basketball team, you want a real tall guy, a short, quick guy, and a medium guy. Like, you have a team, like it's, you know, it makes perfect sense. And Nashville embraces that, you know,
I love
in,
that.
In a good way. And it's, George Strait's had like a gajillion hits and hadn't written any of them. It's like, so Nashville embraces songwriters, and it's like, it's built, it's literally built on songwriters.
Sure.
Which is, you know, amazing.
Speaking of built on songwriters, okay, so here's some 6 degrees of separation for us. Your cousin is Will Hogue.
Correct.
Will Hogue was on tour, and his pedal steel player is a guy named Adam Ohlendorf.
Yes.
Adam Ohlendorf taught me how to play guitar because we lived on the same street when I was 9.
Oh, shoot.
Through my childhood. Because of that, they were on tour with Sugarland when Will was on tour with Sugarland. And I just met my then girlfriend, now wife. And she loves country. And I liked country. My dad loves country. But again, like, I liked it. I didn't understand it yet. I hadn't had any cuts yet. I was trying to learn how to do it. But Adam was in town with Will. And so he said, why don't you come to the Greek in LA? So I came to the Greek and I brought my wife. Now, and it was our first date. Was going to see your cousin play at the Greek.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and we walked in. She got me like a cowboy hat, and I wore a cowboy hat because I was like, I'm going. And she thought I was just going to be another Hollywood guy. Instead, I'm like, no, I'm
not
cool.
You put on a cowboy hat.
Put on a cowboy hat. I went into this thing. We went backstage and met Will, and obviously, I've hung out with him since, but that's actually our 6 degrees of separation happens long before you and I ever.
When was
together.
That? That was probably
had to be, you know, 2010, 2011, something like that. 2010.
Adam Ohlendorf, he used to play on a bunch of demos for me, and still to this day, I'll use him on a random thing or you know his whatever. But the first country hit I had was a song called "See You Tonight" by Scotty McCreery that Adam played on the. He played all the parts on the demo, all the steel and all the guitar, whatever. Like the very first country hit I had, he played on that, and that's amazing.
Well, so to go to that, because I figured that was a good transition,
that's
because
great.
To be honest, that's really like, you know, you really start breaking into the country world around 2012.
Yep.
That's probably around when we met.
Yep.
And at the time, you got the new theme song to
the Chevy. Yeah.
And Chevrolet. It was and it was a song called Strong that you wrote with Ashley Gorley, mm-hmm. and that you and Will Hoag sang yep. it. And that becomes like a new...
Yeah.
Was in a way, was that your first?
That was the first, like, real, like, legitimate. That was the first money I ever made from a song separate of a draw, necessarily. It was the first, like, oh, you actually got a sync, and, like, here's some, you know.
Here's some real adult
yeah,
money
like, here's, you know, like, yeah. So that was insane how that happened. I don't know if you've ever done those kind of commercial pitches, jingle pitches, I guess. And there was like a year when I was at my publisher, Warner Chappell, and I was doing these random, there's a guy who runs that department called Frank Domeno. You know Frank, named Frank? He's a New York guy, but he does like kind of all the sync stuff. And I met him, I was in New York, and he had, you know, sent me little things of, try to write a song for a McDonald's commercial or Kmart or Gap or whatever. And I did all these ones and, you know, I'm just, you know, trying anything. And I got real close on a couple ones and I didn't get them. But the Chevy thing came along and the whole town kind of attempted it. Like it was like, hey, wanted this kind of song for this kind of thing. And I wrote three songs for that pitch. You had like a week to do it. And I wrote three songs and that one, you know, just kind of...
The thing is, once you get those moments too and you kind of feel like, oh, well, I can repeat this, or I can, or at least you feel like it's attainable enough to be. Because in a way, getting a big license like a Chevy commercial that becomes the theme song of a big car company,
it gave me a lot of confidence. It absolutely gave me confidence.
Exactly.
I look at it as, remember the first time I kissed a girl, you go, oh, I can do that. I can.
Yeah,
it's not that scary. Like I have more confidence. Let me try that again, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, so I remember getting the Chevy thing. I remember kind of going, all right. Now I'm here, and you know, and also that was at the very, you know, I was about to be dropped. I was like a month away from being, if you want to get into my like last second buzzer beater of
how did you know you were going to get dropped?
So okay, I signed a deal in 2010 with Warner Chappell and Combustion Music and Ashley Gorley Tape Room is a whole big partnership, and I was kind of signed as a pop urban guy.
Because you had the Lecrae.
At that point that hadn't happened yet.
Right.
I was in town and I had met Ashley and, you know, he's a big successful country writer but he was just starting to become that big writer. He was still early on for him and I was the first person he ever signed, but I was kind of signed with the intention of, hey, I'll make a bunch of stuff and he and I'll go to LA and we'll try to get in some rooms in LA. And I did it for a year or two and just, I mean, in hindsight, it's hard for me, a guy here in LA, to beat at the time Luke and Max. And I like, am I going to beat them? Like, you know what I mean? It's really hard. So I'd go out there and I would do LA trips once a month and I'd go for a week or so and I'd write with any and everyone I could and I'd be writing hooks and sending them to Ashley.
But
and
the goal for you at the time was to be successful in pop music.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. It was totally to be
so
to be
in
pop
music.
You
weren't even aiming for
country. Wasn't aiming for country. So the year, you know, first year goes by and then typical Nashville publishing deal. I get picked up from a next year. And at the end of that year, you know, at that point, the publishers paid you some money. And if there's been no money coming in, they can't just keep paying you forever. You know, it's an investment, it's business. I get it. And, they don't want to pick up my third year option, but they don't want to drop me. So they decide to do a 6-month extension of my second year. And they're like, hey, let's just try 6 more months. Let's bet on 6 more months. So 6 more months go by. Nothing happens, you know, and I'm, you know, still just plugging along. At that point, my wife's pregnant. We're married. It's our first kid. You know, it's the only time in my life I've ever considered quitting. And it wasn't considered quitting. I was like, I might just have to do something else. Like, you know, if I'm going to get dropped, So
what would you have done?
I don't know. Like, I have no idea. Like, praise Jesus that I didn't have to. Like, it was, so I signed a second 6-month extension and it ends December 31st, 2012 or something like that. Yeah.
Oh, 2012. Right.
December 31st, and I met Sam Hunt in October, and we wrote Cop Car 2 weeks later. And from that point, it all
But Cop Car hadn't even come out yet. So
Cop Car, it took about a year. But when we wrote that song, if we want to jump to that song, when we wrote that song, it was instantly a big deal around town. I've realized now, after being around for a few years, that songs like that don't come along very often. Like, we wrote it and the whole town kind of got a little bit of a frenzy about it. It was a good song, you know?
Yeah, and people just want
it. And it was three. Yeah. Sam was a nobody. I was a nobody. Matt Jenkins, the other writer, was a nobody. We're all just new dudes. And it's kind of, there was a little bit of who are these guys and how do they write a good song, you know, kind of thing. And it opened a lot of doors. And that's that song specifically. And, you know.
How did you write that song?
Typical day. I met Sam about a week before. He and I wrote our first song together. And then like a week later, me, him, and Matt Jenkins, just a typical Nashville thing.
He wasn't trying to do the artist thing, though.
He didn't know yet.
Yeah. Did you know it at that time?
No, no. At that point, he and I had clicked. And the first time I met him, we sat there and talked for hours. And I was like, are you trying to do the artist thing? And he's like, he wasn't sure. Like, songwriting is his first love. He's a songwriter at heart, and you know, strip it all away, he's a songwriter, and so he didn't quite know, because there's a commitment to being an artist. Like, it's a decision, you know, and so he didn't quite know, but he started to accumulate these songs that I feel that only he could do. You know, he has a song called Take Your Time that was a big hit for him, that
never heard of it.
But I wish I wrote it. I should sue him. he started to have these songs, and like, they were so him, you know, and like, couldn't imagine anyone else doing them, you know. So he was like, you know, and at the end of the day, Sam's real competitive. He's like all those people. He's trying to win. And
so when you guys start writing and you have Cop Car, mm-hmm. and there's this frenzy, when did Keith Urban hear it? And was that sort of like a giant shock? Was there, when you heard that he wanted to cut it, were you out?
I'll tell you a story. It's a good story. So we wrote it. We wrote Cop Car. And at the same time, that year earlier, I'd been writing songs a lot with Jerry Flowers, Keith Urban's bass player. I've been writing a bunch of songs. And Jerry would always play these songs that we'd written to Keith. And coincidentally, at that same time, Keith and Jerry hired me to come out to LA and help program stuff for Keith's tour, program tracks and just help beef up some of the music for his tour, which was a great opportunity for me. You know, I'm still at the time dead broke and got nothing going on. And Keith, you get a call from Keith Urban, hey, will you come out and help me arrange my tour? Yes.
Doesn't matter what the thing is after.
They're asking me
will
what my,
come out? Yes.
They're asking me what my day rate was. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means.
$10 million.
Yeah. I can't remember, but either way, it was awesome. So it was like in a month, I was going to go out to LA and do a week out there. And in that time, he heard Cop Car. I'm pretty sure my publisher, Chris Farron at Combustion Music, I'm 99% sure he sent it to him. But Keith didn't know that I wrote it. He didn't know that the guy whose tracks he was liking, the guy who was hiring to come out there, he didn't realize that it was the same guy. He just loved this song, Cop Car, and he also loved these other guys' sounds. Somewhere in that month of us coming out there, he put it together. I don't know if Jerry told him or whatever, but the first day at rehearsals, I'm in LA at SIR or whatever room, and I'm, you know, just sitting there with my laptop, and I'm just trying to be one of the cool kids, because I've never been, still not, but still never been in the, you know, room with super talented people. And Keith walks in and he comes up to me and introduces himself and gives me a big hug and gives me this look and says, me and you need to get in the studio sometime, my friend. And like, I had heard that he had heard Cop Car, but I can't be the, it took everything in my power not to go like, Keith, you know, do you like my song, man? You know, I'm just trying to be cool. I'm like consciously saying, play it cool in my head.
Very professional.
But I'm like freaking out. And first day, he doesn't say anything. That night, my publishers are calling me. They're like, did he say anything about the song? Did he say anything? I'm like, no, he didn't say anything. I'm just going to play it cool, keep playing it cool. And the next day, Keith, I swear he did it to me on purpose. He knew he was going to give me a memory. Like, I swear he like, so I'm sitting there the next day with my laptop, my drum machine program, whatever I'm doing. And that guy, and I'm so glad he did, he walks over to me with a guitar. We've never talked about the song before. Sits down next to me and starts singing me the song. He goes, we drove right past that no train. I'm sitting there like, I'm like, that's I'm like, this dude's singing my song to me, you know, and he knows what he's doing. He totally knows what he's doing. And I'm totally fine with it, you know. So he sings literally the first verse and chorus, and it ends. And I remember going, man, that's what do you say? What do you say?
You like turn the other way and sniffle a little bit and like wipe the tears from your eyes and then turn back and be like,
exactly. I didn't know what to do. And I just remember, I don't know what I said, but I'm sure it was like, man, that's great. Good job. You know, I don't know what you say, you know, because I mean, I'm dead broke, wife's pregnant, about to lose my publishing deal. Like, I mean, it's like, and like, in hindsight, it's like, it's a buzzer beater. It's the last second, you know, wrote this great song right at the very end. And then we talk, and 2 days later, we're at some studio out in LA cutting the vocal to it. I'm like literally changing my life.
Sure.
And he let me produce it, which was insane. In hindsight, he let just a no-name dude produce. Luckily, the demo was real close, so that it wasn't that far to go, and he could kind of hold my hand along the way if I happened to totally take it off course. But he sang it out there, and you know, it was like, I'm gonna say the third single off of his record. I started to get a little nervous, you know, because I'm like, oh, this is about to be first single off a record, and, you know, and it's not. And then the next single, and it's not. And I'm kind of like, oh, shoot, man, is the best song I've ever written just going to be a cut? You know, because you're trying to get on the radio. And yeah. And luckily it was. And,
I'm still waiting for Shame to come out.
He's going to go back two records.
That was my only Keith Urban cut. Yeah. And I was just hoping that when Cop Car came out, I was like, good, keep going. Because if there's a hit, then maybe they'll keep following it up.
Yeah, you want them to be hits.
Once you're past like the fifth single, you're kind of like, he did
Somewhere in My Car, another Car song.
Yeah, right, I know.
Which
right.
I'm sure you're sitting there going, there's no way he's going to put that one out.
Totally.
You're not putting out two Car songs.
Well, plus this is what's interesting about Keith, is that he knows more about pop music than any pop writer I know.
He's extremely sharp. Like,
he knows, he'll tell you about playlists that are current within the minute. I mean, he shows up and he knows what's going on on Spotify right now, what is cool. He knows all
that. He loves music more than anybody.
Yeah, so
he's a music nerd.
He doesn't care about country or pop. And that's what's kind of interesting about, you know, obviously you're the same way. It's like you're trying to... You're just writing your music that's so clearly deeply rooted in not just, it's not like Merle Haggard country as the kind of music that you grew up on. It was like you were into Dr. Dre meets country.
See, I could tell you, I don't know anything about Merle Haggard or Johnny Cash. I don't know any, you know, it's just not, I don't know anything about the Beatles either. It's like, it's no disrespect to Merle Haggard. I don't know anything about the Beatles. I don't know anything about Prince. But I know a lot about Dr. Dre, and I know a lot about E-40 and all of these guys. Like, you know, just certain things just didn't cross my path. And but I'm, you know, a 90s kid, and I was in Nashville, so 90s country is in me, which that's a huge era of country music. And back to that, I feel the divine plan. I never moved to L.A. I never moved to Atlanta or New York. When I had this pop training, urban training, and then all of a sudden I start to write country music, it sounds like Cop Car, and it sounds, you know, like it's only natural that it's slightly urban leaning and slightly pop leaning. But it was the perfect timing, you know, of the genre kind of collided with urban music right at the time I was getting going in it. Nashville really embraced me. The songwriting community really embraced me because I had spent 15 years making.
You earned it.
Yeah, like I trained.
Showing that you were.
Yeah, so when I get in big rooms real quick.
Yeah.
Like I was a new guy in Nashville. I was a freshman, but I had kind of the chops of a senior kind of thing. And I started getting big rooms, and I was real quick. I was real proficient, and I was. Mixes were good and all that kind of stuff. And.
Well, I mean, obviously, you start getting these. You go from, I'm about to get cut. Oh, I'm gonna write a number one Cop Car kind of record, but then all of a sudden you have Dirks and Jake Owen, and you have, you know, Scotty McCreery, and it seems like it's becoming natural for you to start writing at least major label big name cuts, and getting used to it. Were you used to it by the time you start? Because you had a number of the Dustin Lynch records, you know. did Cop Car open the door for Dustin Lynch, or was that even before? Were you starting to work on that before Cop Car came out? Because all of a sudden you start getting hits on
Cop
a regular
Car, I would
basis.
Say, is the specific kind of pivotal song that it was a songwriter's song.
Uh-huh.
Every writer in town was, I say every writer, a lot of writers in town were really excited about that song. So it got me in a lot of rooms. So then I had the opportunity to write with a bunch of people. And now at that point, it's on me to do my job and write good songs with those people. Right. And at that point, it just kept going. And so far, it's doing
good.
Yeah,
and also your bar gets raised. You know what I mean? Yeah. Once you start having, if I have to put in this kind of effort to get one, then I need to put in this kind of effort on all of them.
Like, I remember...
And it starts to get really exhausting because you can't just walk into a room anymore and be like, oh, let's write a song, and then you leave for the day. Instead, it's like you walk in, you're thinking, man, this better beat every other song this artist has written so far for this album, every other song that everyone else is writing in this entire town, and maybe even other towns.
It's all of a sudden it got real hard. But I remember when writing Cop Car, I remember having a feeling when we were writing it, a feeling that I never felt before. Like, I knew it was good. Like, I was even that day, as a dead broke, no name dude, I was aware that, hey, this is real. Like, it got real good all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So now I know what the drug felt like, and now I'm kind of aware of that. Because you've been in it long enough to where you know when something's pretty bad. And so you know when to kill certain things. You go, this isn't any good. We should just throw this away. And the painful part is you know when something's okay.
Yeah.
But you're in it and you kind of got to finish it. You know, those get painful,
And I know a lot of people who are really good at just stopping it. And it's heartbreaking, but then maybe you have a shot at writing another song.
I can stop it sometimes, but I anytime I've done it in like rude ways, and like there's like an art to doing that of kind of going, hey, this isn't any good, right? And we should throw this in the trash.
Right.
Like,
we all recognize
it's hard.
This
like
isn't
it takes
good, right?
a certain. I get there are a lot of times where I want to say that, but I just don't have the courage to. Like it's some people do, and I love it when they do. You know.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So you go, the Dustin Lynch records, you know, where it's at, mm-hmm. Hell of a Night, these are number one mm-hmm. songs. And I don't know exactly the order of what happens in 2014 because it seems like they're just all come out at the same time.
Yeah, it was a good year.
It was a good year for
sure. It was a good year.
And that's also when Sam Hunt really, breaks.
Yeah.
So you're on one hand working as a songwriter and a producer, and then you start working as like, because you and Sam have such synergy, mm-hmm. at this point you start working as... in a weird sort of way, as an A&R guy. Because when
Absolutely.
Your main co-writer is starting to become an artist, you then become the guy encouraging that person in a different way than a normal co-writing relationship.
Yeah. It's weird. Sam is, the biggest thing that has ever happened to me personally, because I wrote Cop Car with him, and his artist thing is obviously affected my life. But he is... fabulous at delegating jobs, at getting people to do things and putting people, he saw something in me from the day we met And he didn't care if I was super successful or a new guy or whatever. He saw that I had some sort of angle in my head that I was able to think, and he's embraced it, and he gives me the freedom to do things. He listens to me. He doesn't have ego. He listens to me when I suggest things, or, you know, if we're talking about any branding thing or any tour thing or Instagram or a lyric of a thing, he listens to me. And he still, at the end of the day, has the final say, but he embraces his team.
How did you start going from, you know what, not only am I you know, in a matter of I'm going to get dropped to I'm going to now sort of take on a role as, I don't know what I guess A&R guy, manager almost.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I mean, it's like, you know, Sam, early on, he and I found a way to incentivize me on the whole thing.
Did you just walk through that door? Or were you nervous
I just kind of started doing it. Yeah, okay. So when I first met him, we were just writing songs. And at that point, he had just had his first hit with Kenny Chesney, a song called Come Over. And I can't remember the timeline, but at whatever point he decided to pursue the music, to pursue a solo career, an artist career, me, coming from the underground hip-hop world, I was working with him regularly on things, and I said, hey man, we should put out a mixtape. I was like, we should record a little mixtape and just give this thing away. This is what I've done for 10 years with these underground rappers and singers. I was like, we should just put out a mixtape. And Nashville had never done that before. Nashville's, you know, typically behind the curve on a lot of things. And
right.
So he and I made an acoustic mixtape.
So crazy.
Just at my house. You know, like we purposely kind of dumbed it down and made it sound rough and raw, made it sound like a thing. And I hosted it on my Dropbox thing. And he just, you know, at that point probably had a few thousand Twitter followers, you know, like, I don't, you know, hosted it on my Dropbox, and it was one of those things. It kind of just spread, you know. I don't have any numbers of. I've tried multiple times to track down numbers of how many times it was downloaded or spread or whatever. But it downloaded so much, it crashed my Dropbox thing, and I got contacted by someone there saying, "This is not, you know, you can't do whatever you're doing with this service. You can't do that. That's not what this is for," kind of thing.
Right.
And which was awesome, you know, like, yeah, totally what you want. And
if you get kicked out of using Dropbox, yeah, you're doing something, yeah, right.
So it was spreading. Yeah. And at that point, he starts to go on the road and develop a touring thing, and then he has, you know, tons of fans singing all the songs because it just kind of spread. And so that was early on. In that, I'm telling him, hey man, I'm kind of using the words we, yeah, we should go shoot a video. Like, we should get a YouTube presence. Like, sure. So I'm just kind of, he's such a songwriter. But he saw that I had ideas, and he was, you know, just embracing those things. And you know, we didn't know that it was going to work so well. You know, we were just, right, you know, just kind of just chipping away at the thing. And
do you think it works well because of the fact that it crosses genres, or do you think it works well because it's his voice, or is it?
I think it's a bunch of them. You know, I think absolutely crosses genres. Like it there are a lot of people that were raised on country music and urban music. Like it's my taste, I think, and his taste are in line with a lot of people. You know, totally. I think a lot of people love.
We've talked
R. Kelly.
To Luke, and you know, you talked to Luke Laird, and we've, you know, mm-hmm, obviously,
yeah, exactly.
Ashley's, he's like coming to Nash, or comes to LA a lot to write. And when we're in LA, or mm-hmm, you know, we were just in Vegas writing, it's like, yeah, you know, it's okay to not feel like you have to be, I'm this genre in an, yeah, era where there are no real genres.
Yeah, it's hard to, it's a little embarrassing even talking about setting boundaries on music. It's a little like, foolish.
It's a little dated right now.
It's a little dated. It's like, yeah, really? Are we still doing, yeah, that? It's, you know.
So you go from, you know, once Sam breaks, he's got Take Your Time, Leave, mm-hmm, the Night On, House Party, just huge records. Mm-hmm. All this changes. Do you start feeling more stable at this point? Or is there a part of you that's like, oh no, I'm still going to lose this publishing deal? Like,
you have a part of that at all times. Like, I'm still like, there are times my publisher will call me and they're like, what you doing? I'm like, I'm working. Like,
right,
kind of like, I'm, you know, I'm not on the couch. No, no, no. I'm in here. I'm like, I'm working. Like, as if someone's going to get mad at me for
and
taking
kick you out.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, but I think that's a good thing. Like, I think that's, but no, I think there's part of me always thinks I'm going to be kicked out of town, but, you know, hopefully that doesn't happen.
The next year you get some more big names, you know, Easton Corbin and Billy Currington. But the big next name is Carrie Underwood.
Yeah.
How do you meet Carrie Underwood?
Her manager, Ann Edelblut, who's super duper sweet, and they've embraced me. Right after Sam's record came out, she emailed, actually called me one day. Yeah, Ann called me and asked me to come in just for a meeting to, you know, want to meet me. And so I go in, you know, terrified. And I realize in hindsight, they were trying to figure out who made that record, who made that Sam record, you know, like who was, did I do that or did Sam do that? You know, kind of like,
right.
So, you know, they were just kind of feeling me out and, you know, probably seeing if I was a nice guy and would potentially be easy to work with. And, you know, you know, I think they're just, you know, doing their due diligence and they embraced me. And, you know, I think right around that time I got to write with Carrie. I wrote with her and Ashley, wrote a song called Heartbeat, which ended up being a hit.
That sounds really good.
Thank you, man.
It's the best song on that album.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, you've got a lot of songs on that album, but that song is pretty
Thank
incredible.
You, man. That's that was one that when they asked me, Ann called me one day and said, hey, would you produce that song, Heartbeat? And would you be okay if Chris Lord-Alge mixes it? These are like,
idols.
What do you say to that? Yeah. Like,
no.
No, I'm not going to. Like, I remember going, yeah. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, like, so of course, those are like, I remember where I was standing when she asked me that. And it's like,
where were you standing?
In my studio. I mean, just there in my studio, but I remember pacing, you know, as she's, you know, and I'm like, I don't know what they're going to ask me. She's like, hey, we love that song Heartbeat that you wrote with Carrie and Ashley, and wondering if you'd want to produce it and if it's okay. Chris Lord-Alge's mixing this whole record, you know, do you think it would be fun, you know? And I'm like, what?
Right.
She could call me and yell at me and like cuss me and telling me to, you know, this is what you're going to do. And I would, you know, bow down and say, yes, ma'am. And, but, you know, yeah, it's crazy.
Did you run throughout the house when that phone call was done and be like, you know?
I can't remember, man. I'm sure I, you know, freaked out, but it's crazy, man. Like that, I remember I had a goal when I first met them. I was like, oh, I want one song on her record. I was like, you know, like a realistic, I bet I can get one on her record. I'm gonna try really hard and get that one and to have-
You had a handful.
Have three, and it was three number ones in a row off of her. Like it was, I remember being Heartbeat, she sang it, Sam sang background vocals on the song, which was awesome.
Oh, that's him singing background.
Yeah, that's him.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, that was when I'm doing it. And I called him. I was like, hey, I got an idea. What do you think?
Did fans know that?
It's definitely a known thing, but it wasn't like a marketed thing. It's a little bit cooler when it's not milked to me. It's a little bit.
Otherwise it would have just been featuring.
Yeah.
You know.
And it's just, sometimes those featuring things just get a little...
No, but it's so close to being a duet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
but it's just right. But I remember this is just one of those life stories of she sang it on the Grammys a year or two ago, and I was there at the Grammys. They let me arrange the music and the whole thing, and I was there at the Grammys, which is just a weird sentence,
right?
Sitting downstairs with Carrie and Ann, and they looked at me and they said, "You want to tell him?" And they're like, "Hey, Church Bells," another song I wrote, and they go, hey, Church Bells is going to be the next single.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, God, you know, I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh, my God, that's going to be two, you know. And at that time, Ann looked at me, and I don't know if she was doing it on, like, if she knew what their next move after Church Bells was, but she goes, and we really love Dirty Laundry, too. And I'm kind of like going,
right,
what are you saying? You know, kind of like, well, are you about to tell, like, you know,
I
didn't mention anything. I was just kind of like, oh, great. But in my head, I'm going, like, is that, you know, and they put them all out, which is crazy.
In Nashville... there, or at least in LA, there tends to be a lot of people who have the first single and a lot of people who have the next single.
Yeah.
And everyone has the third single.
Yeah.
Even if your song came out already, maybe they'll release it again. I mean, like the way people talk about songs, it's like, I got the first single. Yeah. And it's like it comes out, and not everybody in town has the first single.
Yeah.
A lot of people just say that. Is that something that's prevalent in Nashville? Are there people who walk around? I mean, it seems like everyone's so humble and kind of quiet.
Yeah, it's
about
more humble.
Stuff.
It's more humble and
so if somebody quiet. Says you have the first single or you have the next single. It's probably because at that point it's true.
It's true. Yeah, like absolutely. Nashville is way more humble and laid back and honest and. Nashville is very paced. It's very organized. It's very, you know, maybe times to a fault, but like it's a very organized machine of, you know, where a certain song is. They'll probably be coming out with another song here in a month or two. And but no, there aren't a ton of people, you know, walking around bragging. And that's probably more of an LA thing.
Right. So you win the triple play.
Yeah. Crazy.
CMA award, which means you had three number ones in a year. That kind of like solidifies you. You know, when you win those kinds of awards, then it's really hard to go back.
Yeah. See, I'll be honest. I didn't know what that was. My brain had never thought, oh, there's another award past just a number one award. There's like a triple. I never knew it existed, to be honest. Yeah. So when they called me
the super duper triple
yeah,
play.
Yeah, I never knew that you could win the Super Bowl. And yeah, like I had no idea. I had no clue. And they called me and told me I got it. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. You know, kind of not knowing. And then I won it the next year as well. And the next year I go, oh, shoot, that's hard to do. Like I was, the next year I was way more aware of, because that's just, I mean, it's hard to, you know.
It's still hard to have a hit.
It's hard to have a hit ever, much less three in a year. Like, I mean, it's all impossible.
We were trying to solve, and it was like our third episode. And I was asking, you know, do you celebrate number fives?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, by the time, you can't because, you know, you don't know when it's going to go to number four. And by the time it's number six, you don't celebrate it because you should have celebrated when it was number five. And, you know, you get to a point where people assume that you just write hits. Like that's just easy. Like your family's, even your family and your best friends are like, oh, there's another one. Hey, I like that song. Some people are just like, oh, it's just people. Now it's just standard. It's like, number one songs in a year.
My dad means super duper well, but like I'll have two songs on the charts. And I'm like, you got anything else? I'm like, I've already, you know,
right.
That's already impossible, you know, like to do. And it's like, I don't have anything else. I just have the number one song and then a great song. But no, I don't have anything else.
Yeah.
So people start to expect it.
I didn't have any cuts for a long time. And when the first year I started getting kind of big name cuts, I had, you know, Bieber and Nicki Minaj and Maroon 5 all the same year. And it was five number one album songs. Even though there were album tracks, it was just like, here's another number one album kind of thing. And I remember saying, my parents started viewing it as like, it was not a big deal. It's just like, hey guys, I have the number one album again, a song on the number one album. This is huge. And it was just like, oh, cool. And then they just started talking about the Botanical Gardens.
Yeah,
and
you realize Park, I Illinois climbed Everest five times. We should be excited
But
about
I
it.
Stopped them and started saying to them, I started figuring out, okay, well, this, and it's harder to do now because of streaming, but I was like, okay, well, this album sold, you know, 250,000 copies worldwide this week. So that's the equivalent of Buffalo. So I'd be like, hey, if everybody in Buffalo, New York bought my song tomorrow, that would this week, that would basically be what I just achieved. And try to like explain to them in like a practical number of like, imagine.
I always look at it like you see a football stadium. You go, there's 80,000 people.
Exactly.
You go, every single person in here bought it times four. You know, or whatever. Yeah. I remember when I had my first number one, it's such a gradual process. Like it's not an overnight thing. It's literally a decade's worth of chipping away at the whole thing. And I remember as the day I woke up and it's number one, and I remember kind of being like, I should be excited. I should be more excited right now. Like, you know, on a bigger note, it made me realize that to me, making music, creating it is still the most fun part, and which made me realize in a super sappy way that I had made it for 15 years. Like some of the most fun music times I ever had was in the bedroom with some of these rappers back in the day, just not knowing what we were doing, but just thinking we're making the greatest classic records of all, you know, it was always awesome. And it was, because I realized that the high of a number one is no higher than the high of making a beat in my apartment off of Edmondson Pike in 2001. Like, it's still at the end of the day, the music is just awesome. And as I was just trying to be so excited, I was like, I got number one song. I should be super excited right now. And it's like, it's always been exciting. That's the, I always look at it, I'm like, I bet LeBron has more fun playing basketball when he plays a pickup game on the weekend with his friends. I bet it's more fun to him. Like, now he loves to be in the championships and be in the finals, but like that point it's real work and it's task and it's like, it's a different game, you know, but I've realized I'm like, it made me appreciate the fun of music that I've had for 15 years. And
yeah. I mean, how happy is happy?
Exactly. You know what I mean? There's no happier than like,
yeah, there's not there. We don't have the words to describe. If you win a Grammy or you win a number one song, mm-hmm. or you get your song cut on an album at all, or you even release your own album and it's finally out on iTunes and exactly. nobody's even paying attention because you don't have a deal, or you finish a song and you play it in at a coffee shop for 12 people and everybody's like, that was great.
Yeah.
Like, all things considered, you're still just happy.
It's all happy. I remember back in the day, I'd make a beat and it would be like in key for the first time. You know, like I'd be so excited because I played a chord progression or something. And I remember like burning it to a CD and literally listening to it in my car for days. Like just because I was so excited that I composed this piece of music and like there was an arrangement to it. And I was so excited. And that's what I realized, like writing hit songs with Sam or Carrie, whatever, it's the same thing. It's the exact same high. Like, and you know, it's nice to make money and all, but it's still the love of music at the end of the day is why right. we all got into this. Like, I don't know if you got into this for the money, but I would assume at the end of the day, you were a kid in your bedroom who just loved music and
yeah, I'm also not, I don't know if I'm qualified to do anything else, but
exactly. You know. That's what you asked me earlier. What would you do? I go, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what I'd do, you know.
But I do, when people say, oh, you know, I would do it for free, that's always the thing where I'm like, well, that's not a very, really good way to look at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's probably a way, you know, if you would do it for free, you're going to do it for free.
Yeah.
If you're going to do it for money, you're going to try and monetize it, which means you're going to be aware of the listener while you write on some level, and you're going to give the audience more credit than yeah. you would if you were doing for free. If you're doing for free, you can write about anything yep. and you can do whatever you want in your
Dude,
room.
There's a song I'm working on right now with Sam, and I'm not afraid to say it. We are working on it. We hit a little bit of a wall, and we're like, you know, we should bring our other buddy. We should bring Josh Osborne in on this song. You know, and for an hour, we sit here and we kind of talk about our egos and stuff, and we're like, then that's like, and he's going to take a little bit of credit. He's going to take a little bit of publishing. You know, we kind of get in ahead of ourselves and we're like, man, and we boiled it down to, we go, man, at the end of the day, if we were dudes working at Home Depot is what we said, and we were working on this song and we thought that Josh would be great, we would call our buddy Josh from down the street, come work on this song with us, man.
Hands down.
And we were like, screw publishing, screw any sort of credits or whatever. We go, let's call Josh. And we called him and, you know, it's fabulous. I mean, it's the missing piece was him, you know, and it's like, but it's, you have to battle your ego a little bit on that. Like, we literally sat here and go, what do you think about that? And it's like, because at the end of the day, I want everyone to think that I'm the most talented person in town. And it's like, and that I'm the reason for all these.
Why?
I'm sure ego at the end of the day, you just like, you know, and that's why I try to be aware of my ego when I, you know, see those things and try to get ahead of it.
I'm not going to call him out, but one of the best songwriters in the world gave a book to all of the people that he works with that says, Ego is the Enemy is the book. Yeah. And that was everybody's Christmas gift this year. And, you know,
that's great.
The greatest of the greatest. Just understand that if you can't have an ego in it, because in the end, nobody, first of all, legacy is stupid. Second of all, you yeah. know, nobody's really paying that much attention.
Exactly.
It's just, and it's way cooler. If you have 2% of a song that is a number one song yeah. and your name's on it, maybe you'll say to your friends, you know, I didn't do that much on this. But for the most part, it's fun. You're sharing these moments. Yeah. You know, you're sharing them with your friends.
It's a whatever's best for the song. It is music at the end of the day. Whatever's best for the song. I always go to Michael Jackson didn't write Thriller. He wrote a ton of other ones, but he didn't write Thriller. He didn't write Man in the Mirror. Garth Brooks didn't write The Dance. And these dudes wrote fabulous songs, life-changing songs for them. You know,
they didn't write all of them.
But they go, they go, that song is so good, I got to cut that song. Yeah. And that's, you know, but it's you get far up in the music business and you start to have hits on the radio and just other things. You start to look at splits and you start to look at all that, you know, you start to look at, you know, how many writers are on the song?
Because you start letting the money.
And that's all I go back to, man. That's what I realized. Oh, man, when I was 20 making beats in my apartment in Antioch, that was awesome. I need to make music like that. Like, you know, and try to keep it like that. And that's with the Sam stuff. It very much is like that.
Yeah, it feels like that. It feels like it's fun.
It's very much like that. His stuff is kind of run by me, him, and his manager, Brad, who's, you know, kind of the other, you know, link to the whole thing. And yeah, but it's run, you know.
So, right. I mean, currently while we're doing this interview, you know, Body Like a Back Road is just everywhere.
Crazy.
It might be the biggest song that you have, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean,
I've already established that that's the peak for me. I doubt I'll ever beat that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm just maybe just glass half empty, but I'm like, that's like...
No, there's that, Eat, Pray, Love thing that, you know, the author for Eat, Pray, Love who does a TED Talk about what happens after you have your statistical apex.
Yeah, at some point
you
peak.
What do you do when you know that it's impossible to repeat... something.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like J.K. Rowling isn't writing Harry Potter again.
Yeah.
She's going to try to write something else that's successful, but it's probably impossible to beat that.
And that's what, because Body Like a Back Road, it's getting some crossover love at Top 40 and Hot AC, and that was never the intention at all. So at this point, it's all just icing on the cake. Like we've talked, like, the bar isn't huge, massive country song and huge pop song. Like we're still just after country music. We're country music fans. We love being here in Nashville and being part of the Nashville community. So the bar, if the next song we put out is only a country hit, that's not a bad thing. Like that's, you know, that's what we're after anyway. But yeah, By Like a Back Road is definitely surpassing any expectations we ever dreamed of.
Is there like an actual effort to go to Top 40 radio
No, it's just happening. Sam's not doing anything. It's just happening. I think it's just a catchy song. It's just one of those ones that just kind of has the magic little sprinkle in it. That
I mean, by the time this comes out, people will know of it as something that has done a certain run or whatever it has. But when you're in the middle of it, we were talking about it in another episode where it's hard to watch charts because some days you're like, ooh, is it? It's number five. It's number six. It's number seven. It's number six. It's number five. It's number
I've gotten. Do you have trouble watching chart? I've gotten comfortable with it over the years. Like I have a callus for it. Like I know you win some, you lose some, so I'm okay to watch it. Like
I'm having a good couple months of not really checking it.
Gotcha.
See, it's an addiction. So once I start looking, it's like, don't do it. Just click it off.
See, to talk about Cop Car again, that song only went to 8 on country radio. It's not a number one song. It died at 8. And it was my first big thing. I was convinced. Everyone told me that's a huge hit. It'll be multi-week number one. It's Keith Urban. It's like, and it died at 8 for some weird reason, which I don't understand. But it crushed me. Because I was like, man, that's the best thing I've ever written. How am I ever going to get a number one song? If, you know, and it's, so I watched the charts that time and I was crushed and I idolized it and I put all these other things in my life. Like, you know, I put too much in it. And so I learned a lot from it. And coming off of that, I realized that there's only so much you can do and you should write the song. And like, so now it doesn't bother me to watch songs die at 22 or, you know, you don't want them to. I was like, it's okay.
But I like that you looked at Cop Car and you were thinking, man, how am I ever going to be this? So now that we just talked about Body Like a Back Road, you're like, well,
yeah,
That was my apex.
Yeah.
And it's like still going on. And you're like, wait a minute. Yeah. Hold on. Yeah. It hasn't even reached. Yeah. You know,
Who knows, man?
What it does.
It's all at the end of the day. Like, how lucky are we, dude, that we get to do this and write these songs and, you know, money's neat. But it's, I just can't believe we could do it. I get to sit here and write in a studio at my house. I have my wife and my two kids upstairs. I get to do this. It's insane that I get to do this. It's a huge blessing.
So I'm gonna name five people, five things. You just tell me the first thing that comes off the top of your head.
Okay.
All right. Keith Urban.
Changed my life without question.
Ashley Gorley.
Changed my life without question.
Sam Hunt.
Wow. Okay. Changed my life without question.
Okay.
Sorry for the next one, next person. If they did not change
Carrie Underwood.
Changed my life without question.
Ross Goldman.
Changing my life without question. There it is.
I had other people, but I kind of think that we had to switch it up. All right. So to finish up, what's a message you would give for an up and coming writer?
We just kind of talked about it. Realize that it's fun. It's always fun. Because I've noticed myself as I've climbed, as my dreams have come true, I've forgotten about the fun part of it. I've forgotten that it's awesome to hear chords playing and melodies over top of them. And when I embrace the fun side of it, it's more natural. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, man.
Well, thank you for doing this. You know, it's anytime. Fun watching your career, because I think both of us really were kind of starting to get cuts the same year, and have gone through this process in a very sort of symmetrical way.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's a very cool thing.
It's very weird, man.
The first time we wrote, I came in, I had seen I'm just going to tell you where it came from. I was on, you know, Broadway, mm-hmm. walking around just being a tourist, because I think it was maybe my first time in Nashville writing.
Gotcha. So you're doing the whole thing, gonna go see the sights and all that.
Yeah. And there was a bar called the Rock Bottom or whatever, and I was like, you know, I couldn't afford really to even buy myself food out here enough. Like, I could barely.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it'd be cool to do something where it's like, you know, I always think there's something cool about that blue collar.
Yeah.
Party, you know, and we've both written that a couple times in our professional careers as we've gone. But the idea of like being like, oh yeah, I could like rock bottom pretty well.
Still a good title. Like, there's nothing wrong. I mean, we wrote a fine song, I guess. I don't.
That's true. It's just fun. It's fun to see, like, you know, this is us writing a song in a room, hoping that we could get cuts, and then to see where we are now is really exciting.
And you know, Adam, the guy we wrote with that day, he's had multiple hits himself. Like, he and I wrote Hell of a Night together, and like, he's
insane. Had
all the hits. He's, you know,
I love it.
It's great that it's all happened. It's very much a blessing.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you, man.
It's fun to share this with you.
Thank you.
And let's write a song now.
Let's do it.
Okay.
If you missed the 51st annual CMA Awards this week on ABC, you can check out the winners and highlights of your favorite artists, including Garth Brooks, Carrie Underwood, Luke Bryan, and many more, by visiting cmaawards.com. Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. On next week's episode, we sit down with Sir Nolan Lambrosa. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.